Our thanks to Storyblocks for sponsoring this episode of Does Not Compute. Storyblocks makes it easy to get all of the stock images, videos, and audio you need for a fraction of the cost. When you sign up for Storyblocks, you get unlimited access to their member library, which includes 400,000 images, 150,000 videos, and 100,000 audio clips. Having unlimited access to all that stock media means you'll always be able to find great companion pieces for blog posts, social media posts, and web pages. There have been so many times over the years where I was working on a page for a client or even something on my own site and would have loved to have been able to pick anything from a huge library of photos and videos. Everything on Storyblocks is royalty-free, which means you can use it for commercial and personal projects. They're working to add new content on a regular basis, so you'll get access to even more great stock media. Normally, access to one part of the library, photos, videos, or audio, costs $149 a year. But if you go to storyblocks.com/doesnotcompute and sign up, you'll get a year of access to all three parts of the library for just $149 total. So make sure to check out Storyblocks at storyblocks.com/doesnotcompute.
Oh, it feels like we never took a break.
Right back at it.
Right back at it.
I can't believe it's November 11th, man, which means that in 7 days, the lease on my apartment expires and I will not have anywhere to live except this RV. It will be non-optional at that point.
That's the best way to experience something is when it's non-optional. You get to experience it in the fullest because you don't have a choice.
Yep. But that also means that I have like 1 week left to get rid of the rest of this furniture and finish repairing the thing. I don't know. It's very exciting. It's extremely exciting. But man, 1 week is not a lot of time. It sneaks up on you.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. So the thing that I found about California is you can put almost anything anywhere and it will disappear.
You mean like leaving furniture on the sidewalk?
Yeah. I mean, you're probably not supposed to do that, but.
Well, street treasure, especially in San Francisco there's a lot to be found there that gets left out and people will just take it within an hour.
Within 5 minutes. Like you could turn around, around and it's just gone. Just gone. I remember ZK telling me a story, friend of the show, Mr. Zach. He texted me one night and he was telling me that he like woke up and he looked out his window and in Santa Cruz, it gets kind of hazy. And so he looked out his window and leaning up against a light pole was a mattress. But not only was it a single light pole and a single mattress, there were two mattresses leaning up against different light posts in the same crosswalk intersection.
Yeah, see, that's the danger is this would happen at my last apartment in SF. Occasionally a shoe would show up.
Yeah.
And then later that day, another shoe, like not a matching shoe, completely different shoe, would just appear. And then eventually both of them would go away. It's such a strange, it's whole own ecosystem.
Maybe it's a startup we didn't know about. Some new app that the kids are using. It's like City Shoe. Share shoes. I don't know.
It's like sending a message that the parents will never be able to decipher. They just communicate in stray shoes.
I mean, I wouldn't put past anybody to do that.
That's one way to beat the surveillance state.
Yeah, yeah. So 1 week. 1 week and you're
1 week.
Is your first destination Sonora?
Yeah, so we're headed back. Both of our families live up in the Sonora area, Sonora, California. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna head there for a little bit for the holidays because you know it's right around Thanksgiving and then Christmas and New Year's are just around the corner after that. Of course. Kind of makes sense. And what'll be really nice about that is we're gonna be parked at my parents' place. They've got a big area where we can work on it and finish up the rest of everything.
That's nice.
There's still more stickers, some more branding stickers to tear off the front. We went up there a couple months ago for two weekends in a row, basically, and had these drills. I've told you about the Whizzy Wheel, right? Have I talked about the Whizzy Wheel on the show?
I have never heard that term, Whizzy Wheel.
Yeah. So it's this thing called the Whizzy Wheel. That's like the brand name of the one I bought. I'm sure there's a more generic name, but it's this yellow flat rubber disc with kind of like little... It almost looks like a windmill with just a bunch of little things flapping off it, though.
I'm looking at them right now.
So you stick this in a drill, and then you spin it, and you set the side of the disc against a car or whatever surface has vinyl decals on it, and it rips them off. And it took hours, and it took like three people, two pretty good weekends of ripping to get all the stickers off, but they're all gone now, except this one on the roof. So I'm going to have to like climb up on the roof and get that and all that sort of thing. There's a lot... A lot still left to do, but it'll be good that we'll have that time to that time to take care of all those things that you can't really do so much in San Francisco.
Yeah, you'll have more space. You won't have, I mean, it's kind of like one of those things where you have to rip the Band-Aid off, I think. Like, it kind of sucks leading up to it, packing all your stuff, getting rid of all your stuff. But once you're in the van and you're on the road, I think that there's going to be like a sense of relief. At least for me, that's how it was. I always would get stressed out before tours because I would handle a lot of logistical things. And once I was in the van with my sack full of clothes and a guitar, I felt a lot better.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's a big part of it is right now I'm even preparing is difficult because I'm parallel parking it outside of an apartment complex in San Francisco. So it's not like I can't go down there and really do electrical work or anything like that because I'll be making a bunch of noise in front of somebody's house. It's just a weird spot to be in. So it's going to be... That's actually been something that we've noticed so far is most of the trips we've done, the most inconvenient parts of it were just the parts that were tied to us not living in it full time.
Sure.
And having to be like, oh, well, I'm going to have to bring this stuff back down and up before and after the trip is over. You know?
Yeah, 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 totally. I mean, that's exciting. 1 week and you're on the road.
1 week. So I've got these lights. I don't think I've talked about, at least not in any detail, about my lights.
I was going to ask you about that because I saw a tweet that said how many HTTP requests does it take to turn on your lights?
Yeah. I said, how many HTTP requests does it take to turn on a light bulb? And the answer, of course, is some of your lights aren't responding. Right. Yeah. It's a Siri joke for all you know.
Okay.
But yeah, so I actually built out, I replaced all of the built-in light fixtures under the cabinets, basically, in the RV. I'm working on replacing with HomeKit compatible lights because, you know, I'm a nerd and that's the kind of project that you want to have in your new RV.
Well, you gotta be able to
control your lights. So they're fully RGB controllable and everything now. Yeah. Well, what am I going to do? Get up in the middle of the night and turn them? They had switches on each individual light. I'm going to turn six switches on and off. What am I, an animal?
You're going to stub your toes. Yeah, yeah, you got to be able to control your lights.
Yeah, lots of downsides. Well, yeah, especially in such a crowded space. Like if somebody's on the other side of the thing, it can be a kind of a pain to move from one end to the other, mm-hmm. especially in the dark as you're turning lights off. So I was like, I mean, let's be honest. Mostly it's just cool. But I now have the system in place. Only four of the lights are working right now. I need to rewire the last two. But it's a Raspberry Pi that hooks into a local Wi-Fi network that's just for the van, basically. And it actually is using, what is it called? It's basically using a node bridge to allow me to expose just little JavaScript files, whatever I write, as HomeKit devices. So then they show up in the phone. And just as if you had a Philips Hue bridge, for example, mm-hmm. you connect to that bridge in the Home app, and then all the lights connected to that bridge show up. It's a similar setup. I can go in there and add a new JavaScript file if I want to either add a new light or add some kind of switch or some kind of monitoring system that can just deliver info back to HomeKit, mm-hmm. all sorts of things that you can do with it. But pretty straightforward. And so now I've got that little Raspberry Pi sitting in my RV powering all my lights, which is pretty nice.
It sounds really fancy. I was actually at Best Buy last night and looking at some of the lights, thinking about purchasing some, but I didn't. I couldn't get Jamie to talk to Google, so I decided not to. She just wouldn't do it. She didn't want to. I understand it. I get it. But that sounds pretty nice. It's just everyone always talks about how developers over-engineer things. Like, oh, I'm going to build a blog. I'm going to use all these crazy tools. And it's a completely over-engineered blog. And it's funny thinking about when I read your tweet last night, I was like, HTTP request to turn off of your lights or turn them on and off. It's just so funny. A local Wi-Fi network to communicate to your light bulbs from your cellular device. I mean, I get it. It's awesome, but it's just... Like, if you really think about it, it's kind of funny.
It's really a lot more effort than just flicking a switch,
right?
Isn't it?
Yeah. I get it, though. You got to be able to control your lights.
You
got to be able to, like, you hear that, you're going to hear that noise, and you're going to be like, is that a rat? Do we have rats now? And you got to be able to turn the light on without putting your feet down there, because you don't want them to get on your toes.
Hey, Siri, turn the lights on.
Hey, Siri, are there rats in here?
I just say Siri.
I did
myself.
Too. Whoops.
Hey, Siri, turn the lights off. Thank you. The bedroom lamp is not responding. Oh my God.
No, that's still pretty cool though. I think it's just, I don't know, it's what you can do with the simple little Raspberry Pi, such a small thing, you know. You can do anything with it. I think that's really cool. Like whatever you can dream up pretty much, you can make with it.
The Pis are amazing. This is the first time, obviously I've been aware of them for, you know, since however long they've been around, basically. But this is the first time I've actually had a good project to use one. So this is the first time I've ever gotten a Raspberry Pi and used it for something. And they are seriously cool. The latest one, the Pi 3, is significantly more powerful than even computers I had in the early 2000s. Like, it's a lot more powerful. It's got a dual core 1.2 gigahertz processor in it. good chunk of RAM. I can't even remember how much, but it's a legitimate computer. It's running a full operating system that you can do just about anything you can do on a Mac or any other Linux machine, basically.
That's
obviously not so much games.
Right. Yeah.
And it has to compile for it. But beyond that, like it's pretty robust. I've been super impressed, and they're so tiny, and you can get them for, I think they cost like $30-35 for the standard Pi 3.
This one point. I'm looking at has an HDMI port on it.
Yeah. All of them do.
What?
HDMI, USB. They're really awesome. Wi-Fi and Bluetooth are built in.
Good grief.
Yeah. And it's just this tiny little thing you can throw and power off a 5-volt USB source really easily. Just throw it in a closet or something and it can do all sorts of things. I've got more projects planned for this, let's just say, for now.
I just need to buy a couple of them and just do something with it. I keep talking about the solar project I want to do, which would be useful because the power went out. Like, a storm happened the other night and power went out. It snowed, by the way, which I'm upset. I'm not happy about that. And
were you there? You were there around this time last year, yeah. Right? So is that expected?
I mean, it's expected. I just don't want it to happen.
It's just the first
the
one.
The bottoms of my pants are going to get wet. My shoes are going to get wet. It's going to make me wear boots, which I hate putting on and off. I feel like I'm sticking my feet into a cave. I mean, rats could get in there in my boots because they sit in the side room I never use. I don't know. I'm complaining about it, but I just didn't want the snow. I walked past. Okay. So one of the greatest pleasures in life is just an evening coffee, having a coffee in the evening. And it makes it even better if you have a scoop of gelato and you just pour the coffee on that. And so I walked past a gelato place last night, an Italian gelato place, and I looked in there and I was like, I don't want that right now. And that's never happened to me before because I was too cold.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the windows were frosty and I saw some guy in there drinking like a milkshake. I was like, what's wrong with you?
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely that time of year. I mean, with the time change and everything, I feel very melancholy for the first, well, pretty much during the entire winter.
Yeah.
But that first hit when you get that switch over and suddenly it's dark at 4:30 or 5 p.m., it can be rough. And it really does change how you, or at least how I, deal with sleep and just life. It just makes me feel weird.
Oh, yeah. You get kind of the winter blues, the wintertime blues. You're not getting the vitamin D.
Well, it's ridiculous because, first of all, it's only an hour. Like, it's not that big of a change, but it feels like half a day.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not actually even a change. Like, we completely made it up. It doesn't actually change anything about how anything in the world works.
Right.
It's literally just setting a number differently.
I saw some people...
A completely arbitrary number.
I saw some people on Twitter yelling at some farmers. I don't really know the origin behind daylight savings time or anything like that. But they're certainly throwing a bunch of farmers under the bus. And I just kept scrolling. I was like, I don't get it. I'm not going to dwell on it. Keep going.
Well, I just kind of wonder... We always have so much trouble with, as programmers, we have so much trouble with time zones and so much trouble with daylight saving switches. Like, basically every time, twice a year, there's a daylight saving switch and somebody has a bug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somebody is bound to have a bug every single time. And that's just always going to be the way it is, I think. Like, I don't think there's a real solve for that other than not doing the time
companies with many millions and perhaps billions of dollars. I can't say in revenue because that's not true. Most of those, like... Well, again, I can't really say that either. I guess a lot of startups, a lot of very large startups that I won't name that have supposedly been valued at many billions of dollars even screw this stuff up. That's what's crazy to me. It's just a part of life when it comes to software engineering.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the issue is that it's edge cases all the way down,
right.
Basically. There's just so many things to account for with time zones or with daylight savings that it's pretty much impossible.
Yeah.
But what I'm really wondering about is what's going to happen when we have fully established colonies, like on other planets, for the moon or Mars, just to start off with. Is everybody there just going to use GMT? I mean, I'm sure somebody's thought about this, but like at that point, if everybody's just using GMT, then why do we still even have time zones on this planet? Eventually, people are just going to have to get used to the idea that there's a single time.
Sure. Yeah.
And locally, what that means for the sun is kind of irrelevant.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The people have to change and adapt to the environment around them, and not the reverse, where we're inventing these rules so that way the environment around us makes sense.
Right. And I mean, I guess we'll see how that plays out over the next couple decades, but that's just kind of interesting because it, for me at least, it kind of, I just don't understand how as a multiplanetary society, the concept of time zones is really going to, I don't think that's going to scale very well.
Yeah. I'm sure someone's thinking about it, and I'm sure I could just kind of like sit back and drink a couple affogatos, and then someone would have put out some open source software that I can benefit from. And then I'll think about like,
and it'll have bugs two times a year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny. Edge cases all the way down. That's something I've actually been thinking about because, like in Design Collective, the most complicated portion is, I think, the shipping. And I won't mention their name, but I think that we might have found a good solution. So currently what happens is there's like three different scenarios, right? There's a scenario where you're buying an item that can be shipped via UPS, and we use a third-party API for that. There's another scenario where you're buying an item that's too big for UPS, in which case we have a couple of regional carriers. But what happens if you're not in that region? Well, you're out of luck. You don't get a shipping rate. It just says, hey, the store will reach out to you and you'll work out shipping after the fact. And then there's...
So when that happens on the store side, do they like email the person directly?
Right.
Or is there some kind of communication that happens through the Design Collective?
There will be communication that happens internally because every app grows up to be and aspires to be a chat app. And so that's 100% in my GitHub list right now. Because I hope Design Collective grows up like every good app. But right now, the messaging changes on the receipts that go to the stores. So if it says TBD, that just means like there's just a paragraph that gets added saying like, hey, you need to reach out to a customer. They're in like a non-standard area or an area that we don't have a carrier that covers that. And so it's kind of like a waterfall. Actually, in the Elixir code, I'm using a pipeline. I'm trying to stick to the idea in Elixir that the subject is always the first argument, because if you have a function that takes a subject and returns a subject, then you can have a second function that takes that same subject and returns the same subject with whatever modifications need to happen. So building out the shipping estimate is what it's called. It's just a struct with like the origin, destination, and a list of rates, basically, from an API. But yeah, so I just have a pipeline of functions that pass this struct through and build it out. And so we used to do things like we used to try to be smart about it, and we knew what UPS's max dimensions were. And we wouldn't even hit like the third-party API if it was too big, just to try to make it feel faster. But I ripped that straight out. And now every request goes to the API. It says, can this be done? And if it can't, then we just fall back to local. And if it can't be done, then we fall back to TBD. But... I'm hoping to replace.
But you think you found somebody who's going to be able to aggregate all of this into a single thing for you? That's really cool.
Yeah, they, like I said, I won't mention their name unless things work out, because they haven't paid me, so I'm not going to say their name. And so basically they offer everything from like parcel shipping to like five different tiers of white gloves. Like you can have people come into your home and put it together and like sweep your floor, more or less.
Really? Wow. Okay. That's pretty cool. That sounds like it'll be a great match for you.
Oh, I would lay down on the floor and cry a little bit if it works. I will send them all flowers.
Do you know yet where, if their shipping restrictions are the same, like are the services, the areas that they can service rather, are they still going to have dead zones that you're not going to be able to ship to, basically?
Not as far as what they advertise. And so I've had a conference call with them.
Wow.
And they ship anywhere within the US. And what's kind of nice is that they have like, we'd have an account rep. So I can actually talk to somebody as opposed to shoot emails into the void. And also what was really cool was that their lead API engineer was on the call as well, which made me feel nice because I mentioned some things. And because our shipping set, like our order setup, is non-standard, because someone can order an object from two different stores, which means that there's actually two shipments happening there.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. So I had to explain that to them. Once I explained it to them, they got it. But yeah, I'm hoping to reduce just edge cases down to one solution, and I'll be very, very happy. I feel like that's what my life is now as a CTO, is like trying to file edge cases down, figuring out how I can simplify it.
It's really funny to me how often we end up working on the same problem at the same time or very close to the same time, because I've actually been, over the last like couple weeks now, I've actually been working on something very similar, not so much directly with shipping, but more just the whole ordering flow. Mm-hmm. Because Nest Notes, we're introducing our first set of products where they were all from the same vendor before, basically. And now there's a new one that can be from a different vendor. So a single order will have to have multiple shipping notifications and deal with those different APIs. Mm-hmm. And so I've just been going through that same thing. It's very funny that we're always, we always have that synergy, even though we're on totally different projects.
Yeah. Synergy. It's pretty funny. I've really just been trying to simplify everything. So like I've been thinking about, I struggle with this. So I've been thinking about checking out, not necessarily Elasticsearch, but another search provider, to help me with keyword searching and stuff like that. But I really am trying to just simplify things. And I know that Postgres has, you can do plain text or full text searching within Postgres. And so I might try to give that a shot, but I'm really just trying to like, all my data is in Postgres, and that's where like the actual application is that's like the DK is the tables in the Postgres database, right? The application surfaces that data from the tables and presents them in a certain fashion, but really DK at heart is a bunch of text living in a database. So I'm really trying to get to know that and embrace it. I recently bought a book. I'll put it in the show notes. I can't remember what it's called right now, but basically it's like just pages and pages full of like SQL queries and explanations and different like kind of like a SQL cookbook for Postgres. And I've been really digging into that. And I feel more, this is kind of dumb to say, but I feel more at one with my code base, at one with my application. Now that I feel like I'm closer, like I'm touching the raw thing, which is the database, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a quote by, I don't know, Atwood or somebody like that, and we'll get in show notes or not. It's not like he needs the exposure. Anyway, there's a pretty famous quote about how basically just every web app is just a front end to a spreadsheet. That's all it is. That's all any web app is.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very true. I mean, that could be databases. Obviously, they have so much power, and there's a lot more complexity to them than this. But at the end of the day, it's really just a spreadsheet. It really, really is.
It really is. I've actually been trying to use spreadsheets more. So I always find myself like looking on Twitter or posting places like, hey, does anyone know of a tool to do this? And then someone will always say, have you tried a spreadsheet? And they were always right because the spreadsheet will solve my problem almost every time. And I think it was Wildborn, right? Friend of the show, yes. Jack McDade.
Wilderborn.
Yeah. Wilderborn. They actually offer a consulting service for, they have a spreadsheet guy. And so you can hire their spreadsheet guy to do spreadsheet things for your business, which is amazing because Google Sheets is free. Like, you know, Numbers is free. Word is like not that expensive. And if you think about how many tools people pay for monthly, that could probably be solved with a simple spreadsheet. There's just a lot of money flying around there.
Yeah, absolutely. Spreadsheets are so, so useful for so many different types of businesses, and they don't require... I mean, this is kind of the funny programmer thing where you're always automating yourself out of a job, but they don't require as much ongoing maintenance from a developer once you've got something that works for your business. So there really are a lot of awesome things about using spreadsheets.
Oh, yeah.
I've been using Airtable. I don't know if you, have you heard of Airtable?
I have an Airtable account and I've opened it twice. I should really check it out.
I'm really liking Airtable for this sort of thing. It actually allows you to model relationships more like what you would do in a database, and you can like jump between objects basically. Mm-hmm. It's pretty nifty. They've got some really cool stuff.
Oh.
And you can also add images in line to cells, and you can just do all sorts of really, really neat things that makes it more, it's almost like a spreadsheet IDE, mm-hmm. I guess, mm-hmm. something
so,
like that.
So this is very interesting. So I've been trying to up my game in like analytics and things like that. And so I've just been creating different flows. Like if someone enters here and exit here, that's a conversion. Yay. And for example, checkout, I want to know where people are leaving the checkout. And maybe if there's most people are leaving at a certain step, then there's a problem with that step, right? So I have a Google Analytics flow that starts at when you start checkout, and there's a step for each page. I think there's like four or five steps in checkout. And so it'll record when people come in and where people leave and where they go to from that. So one thing I want to start doing is adding a couple of buttons here and there saying, what are your suggestions? Are you like confused? Or for example, on the searching side of things, because I know that I need to work on the searching a lot right now. It's just like pretty basic SQL queries. But I want to add a link. And so I was thinking like, okay, well, that can go to an email address, but that's not great. You know, it would work. And so I started thinking like, why not use a Google spreadsheet and just have a form that shoots that into a sheet?
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, but it seems like with Airtable, I can you do relations between can you have like two different sheets and you can link like tables and cells together?
Yeah, definitely. So let me actually just pull up one of mine really quick. So I have one for NestNotes that actually powers the suggestions, like what we recommend to people based on their age and how when they last answered the question and all that.
Oh.
And so all that is actually written out in a giant table here that I export to CSV, and then I have a rake task that ingests that and actually creates the stuff in the Rails system. So in this one, I have moment types, and then I also have a moment type category sheet. And in the moment types one, I just have a column that is called moment type category identifier. And that's set to be a, what is it called? Customized field type, a link to, and in this case, I set it link to moment type categories. You just say, this is a link to, and you select a table that you want to pull from, basically another sheet.
That's super
and
cool.
And then I can click on those to jump to them, and it actually opens up like a little form kind of thing. It's pretty slick.
That's very, very cool. Because there's some crud UIs I need to build out, and I always end up building those UIs out in like our control panel, so that way the other coworkers can like rename tags or add new tags or delete tags or categories and rooms and et cetera, et cetera. Those could just live in sheets because my coworkers already use spreadsheets all the time.
Yeah, it's great for that. And the one thing is you have to be very careful that you have a lot of constraints in Airtable, which you can actually add some things. You can have sort of like validations in Airtable, which you can't really do in a normal spreadsheet, at least not super easily. So that's good, but you got to make sure your input sanitization is really solid because it is very easy, even though it's a lot easier for someone non-technical to edit a spreadsheet than to edit, say, a JSON file. It's still really, really easy to mess up.
Yeah, totally. This is really cool. I might end up doing something like this. I think at least for like collecting user feedback, because there's like you could pay apps to do that. Like there are plenty of survey apps and stuff. But why not just have a form that shoots into a spreadsheet? It doesn't cost you any money. You know, you got to run things lean. Everyone's about running their startups lean now. Got to keep that runway long. You know, why not just shoot it into a spreadsheet?
Yeah, spreadsheets are the way of the future or the past or something.
But I do like that quote that most apps are really, they're just glorified spreadsheets, especially with relational databases. And this kind of gets into something that a friend of the show, Charles, asked about. Basically, he was asking, you know, I can reverse it. So there's like, we just talked about data, like there's different types of databases, and one being mostly like a spreadsheet, you know, tables and columns, and tables and columns that are linked together. And then that would be called a relational database. And then you have this database that's more document-based. A famous example, that would be like a Mongo-based database. And so his question was more or less like, okay, so there's these different types of databases out there. What are they good for? Like, why would you choose one over the other?
Yeah. So there's obviously a lot of depth on any kind of question like that. That we could go into, and there's a lot of opinions that various folks have on those for various reasons. There's all sorts of incentives lying around for people to feel one way or the other.
Right.
But I mean, basically, yeah, at the end of the day, like you said, a relational database just looks like a spreadsheet. That's if you have a GUI for a relational database, most of the time it's just going to look like a spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is by design. And then you have the different tables that each talk to each other. And then a document database, something like Mongo, you have, instead of tables being related to each other based on an identifier in each table, linking them, you'll have like a single item that will contain all of the information about itself. And that's a bit of an oversimplification, but basically you'll just have a single thing. And instead of having to look in multiple places to get the rest of the information about that thing, all of its information will be self-contained. And on the surface level, that sounds, oh, well, obviously that's going to be way better and easier. And that can be true. It really depends on how you're accessing the data. Like, so if you have a document database, that means everything is contained in that one spot. But a common thing that would come up is that you wouldn't be able to query it as easily. You wouldn't be able to look for all of the bits buried deep down in a document that are related to other documents.
Right.
And of course, that there are ways to run these sorts of queries. It's not impossible to query things, but you can have there can be performance.
It's not as efficient. So I think a good example would be like if you have blog posts and each blog post has an author. So in a document database, you would have a blog post document, and inside of the blog post document, you might have an author key that has maybe like a name and an email. So if you have 20 blog posts, you'll have 20 authors' keys with the same name and email, right? And you can query that, and then you can run queries to get like all the blog posts by the same author, but you kind of have to do a lot of more work to get that, because you have to scan all the blog posts, find all the matching authors, and then circle back up the tree and get all those blog posts back. Whereas if you're using more of a relational database, you might have a blog post table, and each row in the table corresponds to a single blog post, and you might have a column in that table that is like author ID, and the author ID, it would be an integer that points to another table called authors, and that ID would point to the individual author. So if you have 10 blog posts, the blog posts don't actually duplicate the author's name and email. They just have the ID that points to the author record in the author's table.
Right. That was a much more succinct explanation than what I was going for. Sure. that was pretty solid, man. Nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, like that's a really good question. So one thing I've noticed is that especially in the Node world, in the JavaScript world, things like Mongo and document databases are kind of, they seem to me, and it's certainly not always the case, but most people like to go with a document-based database. And a lot of people call them schemaless or like NoSQL. Mainly what that means is that they just don't have a set schema. And what I mean by that is when you're working with a relational database like MySQL or Postgres, you have a schema. So it's not a document. You can't just toss whatever into it. So like if you have a schema for a blog post and the blog post has a title and a body, you can't save a created at unless there's actually a column created to hold that data. Whereas with a document-based database or a NoSQL-based database, you can just toss that in there anytime. So some blog posts might have that, some blog posts might not. In a SQL-based database or a schema-based database, you actually have to run some SQL to create that column or add that column to the table, and you have to tell it what kind of data that column is going to hold. This is a text, this is a number, whatever. And so upfront, it's more work because you have to actually create those. You have to create and run those scripts to create the tables and create the columns and set that up. Whereas with document-based database, you might run a function that creates a collection of documents, and then you're off to the races, right?
That actually is a concern that comes up when people talk about document databases, that you're going to have a lack of schema. And I mean, there are actually things that you can do when working with Mongo. Like, that's more of a concern about doing Mongo the wrong way.
Right, yeah.
Because there are ways to ensure that you have data integrity in Mongo. It's not completely the Wild West, but unfortunately, it does sometimes get used that way. So I don't know. I'm trying to be. I haven't done a ton of work with NoSQL stuff. It's been for me. I've been primarily Postgres. I really like Postgres. I've had good luck with it, and it just is a good piece of software, mm-hmm. right? But there are certainly use cases for when you might want to do stuff with Mongo. And actually, I think a great example of this is we've talked about stuff with JSON schema or just basically using JSON B columns.
Right.
In Postgres, and that is kind of a very small scale version of what you're doing with something like Mongo.
Yeah, exactly. Where you're storing more document based stuff that could change often, and you don't necessarily need a hard schema set for it. It works great, and for searching that kind of stuff, also it works great. But I'm not trying to hate on Mongo. I think Mongo is very useful for a lot of use cases, but I also think that it gets abused because it's easier to set up and get running and hashtag ship it, you know. Than having to worry about making sure your schemas. And so the other half of the question that Charles asked was like, what are database migrations and what are they used for? And it's kind of hard to talk about setting up and working with a relational database in the context of an application without talking about migrations. So when I was mentioning you'd have to run some SQL that would create the tables and create the columns, that's what a migration is for. And so basically, if I'm making a blog, I would create a new migration. And if you're using Rails or if you're using Ecto or something like that, you typically would write the code to actually generate these tables in whatever language you're using, whether it's Ruby or Elixir, or you can even do it with JavaScript as well. There's a bunch of libraries that would handle this for you. But you basically generate a new migration, and it's usually timestamped, so that way they can be run in order, which is important. But then you basically just write some code and you tell it, I want this table to be created and it needs to have these fields, and that's it. And so then you run the migrations. And so say if you have a migration to add a blog table, and then you have a migration to add an authors table, when you run them, it would run the SQL. And then at the end of migrations, you would have a table that matches what you specified. And typically you can also roll those back as well. So if you need to go back and make a change, or if you screwed up, you can roll back to my migration and it'll undo what you just did.
Right. And so obviously you could go in with either a GUI tool or directly on the command line and just type these things out in SQL if you wanted to, and that would work. But what's really great about migrations is that they allow you to have that stepping back and forth ability in multiple environments. Mm-hmm. So like you don't have to manually run some SQL script that you've written on your production or on your staging or on every new developer's development box, right? It just means that you can have a very consistent database and you can jump to a specific point in time to have a database that matches exactly that point in time, which is really, really helpful, especially when you need to debug something or, there's a lot of cases where that ability to jump to a specific point of the schema can be super useful.
Oh, even if like you're working with two developers, I can make a change and you can make a change. And when I go to your branch, all I have to do is run the migrations and things are pretty much set. I don't have to be like, hey, can you send me your SQL? Can you drop your structure for me and send it over? Can you send me your database? You just don't have to do it. So it's really a way to organize keeping the changes in order, in sync to your schema. And it makes working with a database that requires schemas like Postgres much, much easier. So it sounds like a daunting thing, right? Oh, I have to actually run code to make the database look like I want it. But I think there are a lot of benefits to that. And I have, like you said, I haven't had any bad experiences with it so far.
No, migrations, they're fantastic. Yeah, they're amazing. One thing that I wanted to make sure we touched on actually is also that they can help you be database agnostic. So in the case of like Active Record, as long as none of my migrations contain code that is specific to like actual SQL code for Postgres, for example, that has a feature that MySQL doesn't. As long as all of my migrations are just using what's built into Active Record and not raw SQL specific to a database, I can pretty much just swap out databases at any point in my application if I need to for whatever reason. And it's not quite as simple as that, obviously, because right. Sometimes there will be other things in the application that need to be changed. But it makes it much easier makes it feasible to do a database swap, basically, because you can change that out and then just migrate up a new database, and there you go. And you're working with MySQL, or now you're working with Postgres, or now you're working with whatever else is compatible with Active Record in this case.
Yeah, or even and
so that can be very helpful.
Even for me recently, when I switched from Rails to Elixir in production, it made it super easy. So during the whole Elixir development, if I needed to make a change to database, I would have to make the change on the Rails side, run the migrations, dump the database down, and pull it back into Elixir for development. And that kind of sucked. And there was also a hiccup where Rails, so typically if you're using a framework, they'll have a table in the database that keeps record of which scheme, like which migrations have been run. And it turns out that both Ecto and Rails use the same column name, but they expect different types. So I couldn't run any migrations on Elixir because of that problem. And you can customize it, but even then it would jack the data up, because then Elixir would see that these migrations haven't run, but then when it would try to run the migration, it would say, hey, the schema already looks like this. This has already been done. So what I ended up doing was I ended up dumping the SQL structure, and in Elixir, there's a task called load, and it'll load the schema structure or the SQL structure into your database. So after any creates, I might create the database, I'll load the SQL, and then I'll run any migrations that I have in Elixir. And it was seamless. Like, I was kind of stressing out. I was like, how am I going to solve this problem? They can't work together well. And then I learned about the load function, and I was like, oh, that's easy. I'll just load the SQL in, or I'll load the structure in, not the data, the structure. And then I'm good to go. I can run my own migrations all day long.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a pretty cool solve for that.
So, I mean, there's like a ton of tools around working with schemas and working with schema-based databases and relational databases much easier. It's just not quite as fast as dumping information into a document. And I think that's good because document databases, in my mind, are great for storing documents, storing text-heavy things, and not necessarily storing relationships. Like we talked about the blog post example. I mean, NoSQL databases certainly can do that, but that's where relational databases certainly shine. That's why they're created to have those relationships stored in instead of just embedding that data in every single document.
Right. And of course, you can model relationships still in Mongo or whatever other document database. Like you can have, for example, you could have an array of object IDs. Every system in Mongo at least has an object ID, which is like its primary key. And you can reference things in that way. So it's not that it's impossible to do, but it's just a different way of working. And for me personally, in the projects that I'm working on a lot of the time, relational databases work just fine, especially with that JSONB layer. That's mm-hmm, that's such an important thing. I feel like that we keep talking about it, but like, man, that really has changed a lot of the way I approach problems, especially around settings and stuff like that. I don't need to make tables for these things. I can just shove them in a little pocket.
Well, they're kind of like documents, right? The schema might change. Well, the quote unquote schema might change often for them. You might need to be adding new columns often. So it makes sense to store it in a document like structure. And I'm super happy that Postgres has that built in. In my mind, it's kind of like you could cut a tree down with a hacksaw, but you would want to use a wood saw for that. Or you could probably cut a piece of metal with a wood saw, but you would more likely want to use a hacksaw for that. So really, I think it's about learning what your actual requirements are and picking the best tool for that job, and not necessarily picking the tool that has the least barrier to entry, in my mind.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Picking the tool that has the least barrier to entry is definitely, that can be a plus and a minus, I guess.
Right. Well, I mean, entry is only for a finite amount of time. And if you make entry good or easier, then that sometimes or often leads to the rest of the time, which is the future, which is infinity, being more difficult. And I would rather deal with the entry being more difficult so that the rest of my time is not as difficult.
Yeah. Well, and I guess really the kind of just comes back down to, once again, really, really, really knowing your tools.
Oh, is that a callback?
It's a callback.
A reverse foreshadowing. I don't know what to call it. Is there even a term for that? I don't know. I'm going to Google it.
Thanks again to Storyblocks for their support of Does Not Compute. Storyblocks gives you unlimited access to over 500,000 stock assets, photos, videos, and audio clips. Access to one part of the Storyblocks library usually costs $149 per year, but if you sign up by visiting storyblocks.com/doesnotcompute, you can get access to all three parts for a year for just $149 total. That offer ends December 31st, 2017.